I don't know what's on your list of New Year's resolutions, but not getting my ass blown off in a nuclear war or meltdown is pretty high on my list of personal priorities for the coming year. I mean, it's true, there are plenty of other things I could be worrying about right now. In fact, I mean, if there was anything like truth in advertising in the U.S., we would have long ago swapped out George Washington's face and E Pluribus Unum on the dollar bill for Alfred E. Newman and, what, me worry? Seeing so many Christian Zionists chomping at the bit for the end times isn't exactly reassuring. And it doesn't help that neither newly elected President Scrooge McDuck nor his co-pilot Elmo Musk has demonstrated the generosity or impulse control of your average cephalopod or cuttlefish. Not that I imagine Joe Genocide Biden as any kind of paragon of restraint, but I can hardly have been alone in banking on Sleepy Joe forgetting the codes after a nice glass of warm milk. But the worm having turned and headed back to the White House, the coming year seems like a critical window to form common cause around putting the brakes on a nuclear industry that's as eager as ever to profit from playing Russian roulette with the planet. The good news is that anti-nuke organizing has a decades-long tradition of effective messaging and mobilizing through art, music, and storytelling. Whether they grew up against the backdrop of civil defense drills, ducking and covering under their desks in the 1950s and 60s, or amid a succession of nuclear accidents in the 1970s and 80s, anti-nuke organizers have produced a rich art of resistance that's helped galvanize and sustain the movement. The bad news is that the nuclear industry is now hell-bent on selling us on small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs, and on repackaging itself as a white knight in shimmering armor, an upright corporate swain bent on rescuing us from the ravages of climate collapse. As that venerable old Jewish peace activist and physicist Albert Einstein famously observed, God doesn't play dice with the universe. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for the nuclear industry, which got a big boost in 2022 with the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA. The White House website lauded Biden's visionary leadership in signing the act into law. Quote, with the stroke of his pen, the president redefined American leadership in confronting the existential threat of the climate crisis, unquote. You'll have to look elsewhere to the Department of Energy's website for mention of the IRA's greenwashing giveaway to the nuclear industry. Quote, Inflation Reduction Act keeps momentum building for nuclear power, unquote, reads the nearly gleeful banner headline. In an even bigger bonanza for nuclear profiteers, in 2024, Biden signed off on a 40-year extension of the Price-Anderson Act, which Public Citizen describes as a billion-dollar bailout for nuclear power mishaps. Environment America explains that the act caps the industry's liability for a, quote, catastrophic accident at any one of the U.S.'s 54 nuclear plants at $16.1 billion in damages, unquote, leaving taxpayers to pick up the tab for the rest. For perspective, according to Reuters, the total cost of the Fukushima disaster was estimated in 2016 at $188 billion. And even at that, damages paid to individuals affected by radiation contamination would almost surely be minimal at best. The industry's recklessness is on full display in an April 2024 report by the Government Accounting Office, highlighted in an October counterpunch commentary by Linda Pence Gunter, founder and international specialist with Beyond Nuclear. The report and Gunther's commentary make clear that we shouldn't waste energy pinning our regulatory hopes on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC. The NRC, as the report makes clear, fails to, quote, fully consider potential increases in risk from climate change, using historical data to identify and assess nuclear risks rather than data from future climate projections, unquote. That's right, the NRC's permitting process does not consistently factor in climate projections like rising sea levels, temperatures, extreme weather events, etc. As Pence Gunter so aptly puts it, the NRC, which is, quote, intent on colluding with the nuclear industry to sell us nuclear power as some kind of answer to the climate crisis, appears entirely uninterested in how the ravages of the climate crisis might jeopardize the safety of nuclear power plants, unquote. And that, kids, ought to go a long way toward explaining how Matt Groening's Homer Simpson came to personify the reckless lack of oversight, accountability, and even common sense at the very heart of the nuclear industry. Given the many well-documented allusions in The Simpsons to Portland, Oregon, where Groening grew up, it's safe to assume that the inspiration for Homer's workplace was none other than the aptly named Trojan nuclear power plant just 42 miles from Portland. The plant, which went live in 1975, became a flashpoint for anti-nuke organizing. Jan Hocken's 2023 documentary, Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, documents the organizing ferment that led to the plant being shuttered in 1993 and demolished in 2005. It's no doubt a tribute to the satirical power of Groening's brainchild that the DOE devotes a website to elucidating, quote, seven things the Simpsons got wrong about nuclear, unquote, while acknowledging that, quote, America's longest-running animated series on Fox has been making nuclear workers cringe on their couches for almost three decades now, unquote. But let's be clear that the real villains in The Simpsons are not everyday workers who work hard and play hard and would like nothing more than to get down. That's a clip from a truly classic episode of The Simpsons that ends with a note dedicated to the steelworkers of America. Keep reaching for the rainbow. The clue to the villain is in the CEO's name, Mr. Burns. The racist roots of the U.S. nuclear industry go back to the 1880s and the Belgian King Leopold's brutal assault on the Congo. From the very start of King Leopold's war, the U.S. was only too willing to collaborate in exploiting workers to death in its quest to liberate the Congo of its resources. And by the 1940s, the U.S. had grown particularly fond of Congolese uranium, which was used to produce the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. If you have a strong stomach and you want a small taste of the scale of destruction and the sheer horrors that the U.S. helped Belgium unleash on the Congo in its quest to extract resources and labor, you might check out the 2021 miniseries Exterminate All the Brutes, written, directed, and narrated by Raoul Peck. Cutting off the hands of child workers was a standard daily practice in the Belgian War on the Congo. In August 1960, Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, who was also a leader of the Congolese independence movement, had barely been in office a month when President Dwight D. Eisenhower handed down the order to the CIA director and veteran coup master Alan Dulles to have Lumumba eliminated. And it's perhaps one of the great ironies of history that the same day, January 17, 1961, that the outgoing president delivered his famous farewell address on the dangers of the military-industrial complex, Patrice Lumumba was killed in a hail of bullets that had Eisenhower's bloody fingerprints all over it. As George Nzelgola Ntaleja wrote in The Guardian on the 50th anniversary of his assassination, it was Lumumba's, quote, determination to have full control over Congo's resources in order to utilize them to improve the living conditions of our people, unquote. But as Angola and Taleja also observed, the U.S. was not about to relinquish its, quote, strategic stake on the enormous natural wealth of the Congo, unquote, and certainly not its uranium. Today, the bloody conflicts the U.S. helped King Leopold and Belgium unleash on the Congo continue, with mass rape and slavery, including of children, used as weapons in the scramble for coltan and other conflict minerals for our precious cell phones and laptops. Especially if you're a teacher, you might check out the Zinn Education Project's curriculum on Congo, Coltan, and Cell Phones, A People's History, along with their broader work on nuclear energy, weapons, and war. In the wake of Hurricane Helene, which killed an estimated 100 people in North Carolina and caused some $53 billion in damages to North Carolina alone, I checked in with a dear friend who's lived there for decades, and I was relieved to hear her house and town had gone relatively unscathed. And when I offered some helpful observations about the catastrophic impacts yet to come from climate change, my friend was suddenly uncharacteristically cheerful. Nuclear energy, she advised me, would save us from our planetary pickle. My surprise was greater for the fact that my friend and I came of age together in the 1970s and 80s, driving the serpentine back roads of Maryland, smoking weed, and listening to the legendary 1979 No Nukes album. The Muse Concert for a Non-Nuclear Future. Looking back, it seems telling that as two white women, we might have worried about getting busted for the weed, but the possibility of death by cop never even occurred to us. The Muse Collective, Musicians for Safe Energy, formed close on the heels of the March 1979 partial meltdown at Three Mile Island Reactor in Pennsylvania. If you want a quick primer on the Three Mile Island meltdown and the organizing that helped shut the plant down, you might check out Heidi Huttner's 2022 documentary, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. Recorded live over the course of five concerts in Madison Square Garden, the Muse concerts featured a host of musical luminaries too many to name. Jackson Brown, Bonnie Raitt, Gil Scott-Heron, Bruce Springsteen, Chaka Khan, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Tom Petty, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and on and on. And if the album helped fast-track Three Mile Island into the lexicon of American disasters, the song We Almost Lost Detroit by Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson highlighted a lesser-known 1966 partial meltdown at the Enrico Fermi nuclear power plant outside Detroit.
Just 30 miles from Detroit stands a giant power station. It ticks each night as the city sleeps, seconds from annihilation. But no one stopped to think about the people or how they would survive. And we almost lost Detroit this time. How would we ever get over losing our mind? The sheriff of Monroe County had a sure enough disasters on his mind. And what would Karen Silkwood say to you if she was still alive? That when it comes to people's safety, money
of the song was inspired by a 1975 book by John G. Fuller about the meltdown. In their song, Scott-Heron and Jackson capture the fundamental irrationality and craven financial interests of an industry that poses an existential threat not just to nuclear workers in Monroe County, but to Detroit and neighboring Wayne County and presumably well beyond. References to the 1974 death of labor organizer, nuclear whistleblower Karen Silkwood highlight the corruption of the industry and its treatment of workers as disposable commodities. You can find a quick primer on Silkwood's organizing and its long aftermath in a November 2024 edition of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, marking the 50th anniversary of Silkwood's death. After her death at the age of 28, Silkwood became the focus of an eponymously titled 1984 film starring Meryl Streep, Kurt Russell, and Cher. But before you watch the film, you might check out the PBS Frontline documentary on Silkwood. A white chemical technician from Texas, Silkwood produced nuclear pellets at the Kerr McGee Cimarron plant in Oklahoma. But she was also a labor organizer with the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, OCAW, as well as a health and safety inspector at the plant and the first woman to serve on OCAW's bargaining committee. When Silkwood detected a laundry list of safety violations, she testified before the Atomic Energy Commission about safety concerns at the plant. Shortly before her death, Silkwood and her apartment were both contaminated with plutonium, but plutonium was not what killed Silkwood. The 28-year-old union organizer was killed in a fatal car accident on her way to hand off critical documents about the goings-on at Kerr McGee to a New York Times reporter. There were indications she'd been run off the road, and by the time Silkwood's body was recovered from the car, the documents were nowhere to be found. While no criminal charges were filed in the case, Kerr McGee ultimately settled a $1.3 million civil suit brought by Silkwood's family. In 2014, Kerr McGee agreed to pay a $5.15 billion settlement, including for, quote, environmental cleanup at contaminated sites around the country, unquote, with Corporate Crime Reporter describing the settlement as, quote, the largest environmental enforcement recovery ever by the Department of Justice, unquote. But the settlement likely barely scratched the surface of damages that Deputy Attorney General James Cole laid out, including to the Navajo Nation. Quote, for 85 years, Kerr McGee operated numerous hazardous businesses, and those businesses caused significant damage to the environment and to communities exposed to contamination, Cole said. In Scott Herron and Jackson's pithy critique, the same nuclear industry that killed Karen Silkwood played dice with the city of Detroit. Scott Herron and Jackson's song is a dirge and a warning, treating the nuclear industry as anything but a menace, a threat to workers and public safety, is itself a form of madness. This is Desiree Helliger for the Old Mulvaney Hour.